Thank you. Please be seated. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in the Department of Protective and Regulatory Services versus Mega.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. This case presents a basic question of whether, in the face of statutory ambiguity, a waiver of sovereign immunity should be inferred. Respondent has relied on cases focusing on lawsuits between private parties, and in doing so has inverted the basic presumption, presuming jurisdiction rather than, as this court's precedents make clear, looking to the legislature first for a clear and unambiguous waiver of sovereign immunity, and in the absence of such clear and unambiguous waiver, finding no waiver. Now, I would note at the outset that a little over a week ago, a substantial, over 50 pages of amicus briefs were submitted in this case, to which the state has not yet had the opportunity to respond in writing. So I would advise the court that we will be preparing a post-argument brief to respond to the dense arguments that were in those 50-plus pages of amicus briefs.
You can do some of it here and now.
Absolutely. The key argument that both amici and respondents focus on is the language of Government Code Section 2001.171. And respondents' argument, framed as a straightforward plain language argument, is not without force. Their argument that the text is broad and that it indeed uses the words "is entitled," if that were all this court were looking at, might well support their position. However, we would submit that when that provision is viewed in context, looking to the structure of the APA as a general and to the structure of how that provision in the APA fits in with the remainder of the code in Texas, that that interpretation does not make sense and is not the best interpretation. There are a number of reasons why the APA and Section 171 does not confer an independent right of judicial review beyond that right that might be conferred by an individual enabling act. First of all, the very next section, Section 2001.172, says by its own terms that the scope of judicial review is as provided by the law under which review is sought. And so the APA itself is envisioning...
But doesn't that refer to contested case proceedings? The argument's been made that it can be parsed through that way.
Well, except 172 says judicial review. And so it frames that the scope of the judicial review is keying off of the law under which review is sought. So
it does, it does have a default, though. Basically, if there's no enabling statute, doesn't have a standard review, it defaults to the substantial evidence. I mean, I see your textual or literal argument, but the truth is, if there's no standard review in the enabling statute, there is a provision made for the standard of review.
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, that's how the entire APA works, is that it's a set of defaults for procedurally how a challenge like this, both a contested case and for judicial review thereof, will ordinarily proceed. But those defaults are not establishing blanket subject matter jurisdiction across the board.
Yes, I mean, this is real preliminary, but I assume that the department at this level that concedes that Mega Child Care exhausted all its administrative remedies and agreed by a final decision in a contested case?
That is no longer disputed. And the point I just referred to is really the key problem with the argument both respondents and amici raise. That if they are correct, if 171 is a blanket waiver of immunity for every contested case proceeding, for every agency in the state, then an entire host of statutes are rendered irrelevant.
Is the legislature still putting judicial review language in statutes that it has promulgated in recent years? Or are we talking about a number of older statutes that may even predate the APA?
Your Honor, it is our understanding that it is both, that there are older statutes and that there are more recent. That is one of the things we will endeavor to do in our supplemental briefing, is do a more comprehensive canvas of that. But it's our understanding that it is both. And in the principal amicus brief on pages 16 and 17, they cite a number of statutes that explicitly provide for judicial review over and over and over and over again. And if their reading is right, every one of those statutes is irrelevant. There's no reason for those statutes to provide for judicial review, because if 171 does it, it's already there. You have judicial review.
But that's how they explain your argument, that by taking it out, the legislature intended to leave it in elsewhere. So, I mean,
well,
it's both ways.
On our argument, they focus on, I mean, that's their justification is they look to the revisor's notes, and they look also to the Sunset Commission and the legislative history. And they say that the understanding was that even though you took it out, it didn't matter because 171 takes care of it anyway. There are a number of problems with that. For one thing, those revisor's notes are, the amici cite a whole host of revisor's notes, but not a single one with reference to 42072, the relevant statute in this case. So they cite other statutes and other revisor's notes.
But that could still be relevant to show that generally.
It certainly is.
But you're talking about us looking at administrative law as a whole.
Yes, Mr. Chief Justice, it certainly is a relevant factor to look at in ascertaining intent. But in those revisor's notes, if the revisors who drafted that believed that by removing that statute they were still allowing judicial review, that was bad legal advice, because it was contrary to over 20 years of third court precedent that was clear as day. That the status quo was, if the enabling statute didn't provide subject matter jurisdiction, 171 didn't get there. And so the fact that the drafter of the revisor note may have believed that in error is not in and of itself sufficient to trump the import of the plain language of having a provision that allows for judicial review, deleting that provision for judicial review, and at the same time leaving in multiple other provisions of judicial review throughout the same statutory scheme. As this court said in the Continental Casualty case, when a statute provides for judicial review in some circumstances and doesn't provide for it in others, the natural inference is that that is for a reason, and that's deliberate.
Can you think of a reason why the legislature would allow judicial review of a child care administrator's license but not of a child care facility's license?
Your Honor, the legislature did not articulate a reason. One might imagine that they could decide to ascribe a greater degree of protection to an individual license rather than to something by an entity. But there's no legislative intent to indicate that. But that is a plausible reason the legislature could have looked to.
Okay.
We are left ultimately with a number of statutes, and they don't fit together entirely neatly. In fact, in the 1997 amendments, which deleted the provision for appeal, they added three Section Ds with slightly different phrasing to 42072. So this was not a model of clarity. But the language that was passed can be given a natural reading. And that natural reading, just like in Continental Casualty, is that in the sections where they provide for judicial review, in 43011 and in 42078, both of which explicitly provide for judicial review, that there the legislature intended to waive sovereign immunity and allow for that review. But where they go into the enabling statute and delete the provision allowing for judicial review, and where they furthermore do nothing to change or alter over 20 years of very clear, repeated precedent from the Third Court, the strong inference for that is that they intended to do exactly what they did. In fact, I would note that Professor Beal, who filed an amicus brief in this case, a short letter brief, that largely quotes word for word from his treatise. And if you actually put his treatise next to the letter brief, you see it going word for word. And it's very notable where the second to last paragraph on the last page ends, because he quotes all the way up into his treatise and then puts a period. And the very next sentence in his treatise that did not make it into the amicus brief reads as follows. The Austin Court of Appeals may have correctly determined the legislative intent, for there has not been a legislative response to its initial holding that is more than 20 years old. So that was Professor Beal's judgment when he was writing his treatise rather than the amicus brief. those 20 years of precedent, it would have been a very simple matter for the legislature, in one sentence, to say 171 waives sovereign immunity for all contested cases.
Let me ask you a question. Now, 171, you say you want something more to waive sovereign immunity. But in all these enabling statutes, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is essentially the same language. It's not going to get any stronger. Do you have any enabling statutes where it says sovereign immunity is waived for purposes of judicial review? Are you requiring more just because it's a general? I mean, where's the consistency?
Your Honor, you're right. There are a number of provisions in enabling statutes that read very similar to 171, and we don't dispute that those provisions in that context do waive sovereign immunity. There are other instances where the legislature has done so more explicitly and said we waive sovereign immunity from suit and or liability.
On judicial reviews?
At this point, I'm not aware of any judicial review, although, as I said in our supplemental briefing, we'll do a more thorough canvassing of that. But with respect, we're not seeking magic words or arguing that that's what's necessary. In other contexts, in the context of an enabling statute, the only meaning that language can have reasonably is to waive sovereign immunity.
What does it mean in the APA?
In the APA, I think it can be reasonably read in the context of the entire rest of the APA and the rest of the code as a requirement for exhaustion and finality. It is not perfectly phrased to yield that. But I think you could read 171 as saying these are the requirements that are necessary for judicial review. They're not sufficient, but if you haven't exhausted or if you don't have a final judgment, you can't have judicial review under the APA. If that is incorrect, if 171 grants subject matter jurisdiction to every agency, to every contested proceeding at every agency, then there are scores of statutes that have been rendered irrelevant. And I would submit it does far less damage to the text to read 171 in the context of the APA and to read it as simply laying out another element of the procedures for how the APA process works, rather than endeavoring to be a substantive subject matter jurisdiction.
Do you have a sense at this point how many contested cases would not be subject to judicial review without that reading of the APA?
Your Honor, we have not met with the many client agencies. That's one of the matters actually our lawyers have discussed, trying to get a better assessment to aid this court in terms of the practical impact. But what we can say is there are a number of statutes that on their face have no other purpose if not to waive sovereign immunity in that specific context. And even this statute, I mean, within the framework of this statute in the Human Resources Code, you see some provisions doing it and some not. And the only way to draw sense for that is to assume that the legislature meant what it was doing.
But that's the only, I mean, there's no real logical basis for which ones the legislature decided to grant judicial review on and which ones it decided not to. In fact, there are a lot of anomalies and absurdities if you look at it that way, aren't there?
Well, Your Honor, I certainly would not suggest that this legislature or any legislature is imbued with perfect rationale. But that being said, I don't think within this statute it's anomalous. The two principal areas where judicial review is applied are one, as we discussed a moment ago, where an individual has his or her license revoked.
Well, but now the amicus says that you'd get judicial review if there's a fine of less than $100, but you would not get judicial review if the business is just shut down.
Well, the amicus omitted a critical element of that fine, which is it's $100 a day. And each day is an individual violation, so that fine can very quickly add up to a substantial amount of money. And it would not have been irrational for the legislature to determine that a fine, taking money from someone, is taking a vested property right from them. There's no dispute that if you make someone write you a check, that's taking a vested property right. And it would not have been irrational for the legislature to determine in that circumstance they'll allow for judicial review. But in the case of revoking a license that was granted by statute and is a creature of statute, that it was less clear that that was a vested property right. And so ample protection would be provided by a full hearing with all of the protections the APA provides within SOA. And I would submit that's not an irrational judgment for the legislature to make, distinguishing between those two.
What do you do with 2001.178 that references cumulative of other means of redress provided by statute? Is that just further verbiage?
No, Mr. Chief Justice. I think it means precisely what it says. First of all, it is cumulatives of other means of redress, of other remedies. So once there's subject matter jurisdiction, this is a remedy in addition to other remedies. The remedies provided under the APA are there in addition to whatever other remedies are available in other portions of law.
Which would be true without 178.
It might, but it is possible that a court would determine the two to be in conflict. We have a remedy in this statute, a remedy in that statute. Which one do we apply? 178 says you apply both. They're cumulative. And secondly, it uses the word means. It is a mechanism of redress. It is not saying this is cumulative of granting subject matter jurisdiction. 178 doesn't speak to subject matter jurisdiction. It speaks purely to the means of redress.
Yes, you are. Question on prior to 1977, the legislature, 1997, when they amended the Human Resources Code, that section that you referenced provided for a trial de novo in the district court. Now, I assume that, I mean, that's a real trial de novo. Is that your understanding?
Yes.
Disregard what the administrative agencies start over the different lawsuit. Okay. And then there was a sunset law in 1997. The legislature came in, struck that provision. Referred these child care administrative orders to administrative law judge. That was new. You get a full hearing there. But they didn't say anything about judicial review. So, it could be, to me, logical that basically they were saying, we're not going to burden the district court with a trial de novo. We're going to send you to the administrative law judge for trial de novo, but leave it to the general APA statute for presumably a substantial evidence. Now, in the plaintiff's petition in the trial court, they asked for a trial de novo in the district court. It went on appeal. That wasn't addressed, but it went on appeal, and it's been sent back for a trial. And if we affirm the court appeals, I assume your position is going to be that he's just entitled, or Mega is just entitled to a substantial evidence review, not a true trial de novo?
Well, Your Honor, our position would be that Mega is not entitled to any
but say if we say they're entitled to some judicial review under 2001-171. What is the standard of review?
I mean, by its terms, if 171 were to grant subject matter jurisdiction, the only standard that would be there would be substantial evidence. And so if this court rules that that is a grant of subject matter jurisdiction, I'm not aware of any argument, certainly that respondents have raised, that they would be entitled to de novo.
So before 97, they were entitled to de novo in district court. If we rule for them here today, they will be entitled to substantial evidence.
Yes, Your Honor.
So that's a legislative distinction anyway, if not intent.
But 97 was a big shift because they went from internal hearings within DPRS to a full-fledged APA contested case hearing with all the procedural protections, the rules of evidence, witnesses being sworn, a full record, all conducted before SOA, independent of DPRS. And so the legislature...
That's probably a standard sunset provision. I mean, you may not know, but...
Yes, Your Honor.
And a transition being made in state government over time through sunset process.
Yes, Your Honor. And one of the things the amici point to is a snippet of legislative history where one senator indicates that the sole purpose of doing so was to conform with the sunset recommendations. But I would note, as this court held in Fleming Foods, that a stated intent not to make a substantive change cannot trump what the language in fact does. And the language before the 97 amendment had an explicit provision granting subject matter jurisdiction to Travis County. After 97, that's gone.
Are you aware of any statutes pertaining to state agencies that say, notwithstanding Section 171, there is no judicial review or no right to judicial review in this instance?
Your Honor, I am not aware.
Figure out what the legislature has in mind. If they believe that the APA creates judicial review in all of these agencies, but does not want review of some determinations by an administrative law judge, would the legislature say so somewhere?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not aware of language like that, but I would expect that respondent and or amici would raise that language because they would urge that language shows the legislature believes the general presumption is 171 grants review. And they have not pointed any such language. I'm not aware of any such language. And the fact that the legislature over and over again has inserted these provisions and has never once done anything to alter the third court's consistent rulings for some 24 years now suggests that is not the legislature's understanding, the particular understanding of an individual reviser notwithstanding.
Let's go back real quick to the original intent. I mean, this was passed in 1975, Section 19A language then is the same as today. It's been recodified and separated. You have no legislative history that speaks one way or the other.
Your Honor,
we've got plain language. We don't have any legislative history.
We have not pointed any legislative
history. We're talking about 1997 legislative history, our intent. But as far as the original
of the APA, Your Honor, we have not pointed any legislative history that supports this. But at the same time, there has been no persuasive demonstration that the legislative intent then was to waive sovereign immunity for every agency in every contested case hearing. And the law was very clear at the time that there was not a general right of judicial review in a contested case proceeding. So to shift from no right of judicial review to a blanket authorization and waiver of sovereign immunity for every agency, I would suggest, would take a clear and unambiguous waiver. And I don't believe that 171's language and context constitutes such a clear and unambiguous
waiver. The other thing, this provision is word for word, much like the entire Administrative Procedure Act is from a revised model, State Administrative Act, 1961 version. You have anything for the court on what the other states that have adopted this exact same language are doing?
Your Honor, we have not at this stage been able to do a state-by-state canvas. But what I will tell you is the amici point to various academic commentators, and there are certainly those who express viewpoints in the legal world who support and would like to see judicial review in all contested cases and have been arguing for that for a long time. I will note that largely what they point to is academic commentary. That has not been the law up until now. It's not been the law in the Third Court, which is the predominant court interpreting this, and it has not been the understanding of the legislature as evidenced by its repeated passage of different provisions and different enabling statutes granting judicial review, all of which would be superfluous if 171 did.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Booker Morris will present argument for the respondent.
Mr. Chief Justice and this honorable court, there are over 8,000 daycare centers in Texas.
8,000 what?
8,000 daycare centers in Texas. The way they are licensed and the way they get contracts are no different than nursing homes, which in this state have long been found to be vested property rights. That issue regarding daycares was never taken up before 1997 because, as the court correctly stated, that right to appeal, when you could just look at it, de novo, was contained in the statute. In 97, it was deleted. But the reference to the APA was not deleted. And in internal rulemaking with the Department of Protective Regulatory Services, it also remained. When you look at the APA, when I was first coming along, and I was general counsel for Labor and Standards and Railroad Commission for John Shaw, we dealt with the APA in terms of how it reformed itself. And around 1995, 1997, people said, look, we need to take these administrative hearings and move them out of the internal agencies because people could not get a fair shot. They formed the legislation that formed SOLA so that you could at least go in front of somewhat impartial administrative law judges. That's how it came about. When they went back and took the protective regulatory statute and deleted that, they left in the APA because of one thing. They knew people would have to have the right to appeal from SOAR. I don't believe that the legislature intended. I don't believe that they believed that they were doing it. Giving away to the State Office of Administrative Hearings the final choice on deciding daycare center contracts and licenses.
Do you think, though, that they knew that the settled law, at least from the third court, was that the APA does not confer jurisdiction?
I don't think they even thought about it at the time. I don't think that they thought that any industry in any industry of that size would, without a battle, decide to give away its right to appeal. What a substantial interest. Substantial interest, much like a lawyer or a doctor or a dentist or bank charter, insurance charter, even though some of those are larger, some of these daycare centers have substantial financial interest tied up. They make a lot of money. They hire a lot of people. They have every right and interest that you would if you were in private practice and someone wanted to come back and say you would not have the right to appeal a recommendation that threatened to destroy your livelihood. They had that from the back in the administrative context without a doubt. It was, even though that section was deleted, Your Honor, it was not eliminated. And if they had
How can that be?
Well, they could have simply, when they took it out.
I mean, you're arguing, well, they didn't mean to, and nobody realized they were, but it does look like they did it.
Well, it looks like they were trying to clean up the statute. And they left in the reference to the APA and Section 2001. And when you look at it, and someone makes the argument that it's simply procedural, the motion for rehearing language is not procedural. It's mandatory. It's jurisdictional. You don't file a motion for rehearing under SOAR, okay, which comes from the APA, you do not get to court. I mean, every court consistently has ruled that. So how come some portions of the APA are procedural, and how come some are substantive? And grant subject matter jurisdiction.
If this, if the APA provision does grant jurisdiction, that would be a big change, wouldn't it, or not?
It would be consistent. Well, it would be something this court would have to determine.
You just said it means what it says.
It means what it says.
In a contested case, you get judicial review. Period.
Yes, sir.
Any agency, whatever.
Any agency, unless in a statute the legislature says you are not entitled to judicial review under this statute.
Are there any statutes that do that?
None that I know. I would say one thing, that the right to judicial review does not involve every agency action. I mean, for instance, under TDPRS, a person could go back and apply for a license, for instance, and not be granted. I think that you could limit their review administratively.
Okay. You're saying they wouldn't be qualified or wouldn't be entitled to a contested case hearing?
Yes, because
and therefore they would not fall under 2001-171
yes.
When that was denied.
Yes, sir. And there are a host of agencies that do a lot of things that don't result in contested hearing finality, quote unquote, but are final as to the actions taken regarding individuals and businesses.
I haven't looked at this in a long time, but I seem to recall that when the Texas APA first came out, it pretty much tracked the federal APA. Has that, specifically with respect to the judicial review section, is it diverged at some point?
I mean, it's pretty much on track with the model.
And the federal courts, at least I haven't looked at this in a while, said that it's not an independent grant, haven't they?
Well, the federal rules, though, are a little different because in the statutes, each statute, they treat them somewhat individually, such like Social Security disability, okay? And the language in each of those statutes is a little bit different. Whereas in the Texas statutes, they are pretty consistent. I mean, back at one time when there was a lot of debate about it, I believe that people put in, you have a right to judicial review because of the confusion between de novo and substantial evidence. As it progressed, it became unnecessary. People kind of assumed that if you had a contested case hearing that was properly appealed with a motion for a rehearing, you could take that case to the district court.
Well, I'm just, it seems like we got two different arguments, two different questions here. One, what does the underlying health code provide? Does it provide a right for judicial review? And then independently, does the APA? And it seemed to me, again, I have not looked at this in a long time, but the Texas Act was intended to track the federal APA, and the federal courts, at least last time I looked, it's been a while, have said the APA is not an independent grant. It's just where a net, if a specific enabling statute doesn't provide for the means for the judicial review or the administrative review, that's where the APA picks up. But I may be wrong about that, but that's my recollection.
Well, I can't tell you
and
exactly.
I'm just trying to find out, did Texas make a conscious decision to diverge from that with respect to the APA?
Well, but I think that the decision that the court is struggling with is that different courts have looked at it and interpreted it different ways.
The third court's done it 24 years one way, and Waco and Houston have done it another way once. So.
One of the fundamental bases, though, for the finding under the third court, it seems to be that it would overwhelm the judiciary. And I can't tell you whether or not it would or not. I mean, 8,000 daycare centers is a lot of daycare centers. But the truth of the matter is that the court, the judiciary, can't just abdicate its jurisdiction to administrative agencies. And in this state, it has never done so. And that is essentially what would happen. It would allow, I mean, say if this statute was correct, if the interpretation recommended by the state is adopted, you essentially have a significant portion of commerce that would not have a statutory right to review by the courts.
But that's
even if they followed all the conditions preceding.
But that's the legislature's call, isn't it? Unless it involves vested rights, we have that exception.
Yes, Your Honor. However, they didn't say that. I mean, they could have come back in this when they did this revision and said, "You do not have a right to judicial review." What they did is they took a section out that dealt with de novo and just referred to the APA. And when they referred to the APA, it's when you look at it with a clear reading, it simply says you have a right to appeal as long as you comply with all of the procedural requirements.
But if that's what they thought, then what's the answer to the state's argument? They keep passing statutes that say you have a right to appeal, you have a right to appeal. Why would they put that in any statute if they thought it was covered by the APA?
Well, Your Honor, it's just probably duplicative, just probably cumulative. I can't explain to you why they do it. I can tell you what I look at and what I read and what it says and what I'm not confused about. I would say to you also that even though the courts do have they have to be concerned about being overloaded with contested case appeals. In a case like this, I don't think that you would have that. I think that you probably have to make the administrative agency a lot more responsive. But right now, the way it's set up, the way they interpret it, the administrative agency could essentially run roughshod over an industry without judicial review.
Is that happening? You say there are 8,000 daycare centers, but you don't say how many of them have had adverse licensing.
I can't tell you exactly. I do know several of them have had adverse licensing. And I know that the issue has been coming up to this point for some time. I do know that there's some pending. And if the court does not address this issue in terms of the statutory right to appeal, and sometimes it has to address the issue of whether or not they have a vested property right, which is a pleading issue, I mean, which popped up in part of the briefs. I do believe that a daycare center license is a vested property right, I understand the state argues that it's a grant and a privilege. At the same time, there are many, many industries where that involve money, that involve time, that involve livelihood, where the courts have ruled that they are vested property rights. And it simply means that the pleadings may need to be changed initially from the appeal process. So it does not mean that you get less cases. What it means is that they simply get reformatted from the appeal process. And the reason why it has not come up before is because you had a de novo trial that was written into the statute before. It doesn't mean that you didn't get rid of the right to appeal. It just meant that it was changed and just automatically reverted to the 2001, 171.
But say we ruled against you on the 2001, 171, mm-hmm. and you have to rely on the property right inherent. And there's, you know, the state's made an argument, seems to be pretty solid, that you didn't plead that sufficiently in the trial court. What's your best answer to that?
The response is that they filed motions for special exceptions and a plea to the jurisdiction. The court never ruled on the special exceptions and allowed us to amend the petition to add the vested property right interest, even though it was clear from the pleadings that we were appealing from a denial of a, we were appealing from a revocation of a daycare center license. If you look at that and you look at the rulings on special exceptions, which allow amendments before final disposition, it would have allowed us to go back and amend those pleadings to allege a violation of a vested property right, which would automatically trigger the right to appeal.
Any other? Are you finished? Or?
I am. One last thing. I do think it does not make sense to argue that an administrator of a facility has a right to appeal to a district court. And out of those 8,000 daycare centers, there's about 8,000 administrators. But a company that owns the business, that pays the bills, pays the utilities, pays the taxes, hires the people, does not have a right to appeal, that the legislature intended such a result. I simply don't think that it's logical.
Why didn't they remove, I understand that, yes. but if that's the case, why didn't they remove the appellate language from both rather than just from one and not the other?
I can't explain that either. I can say that they left in the reference to the APA 2001 because that automatically contained the language that gave you the right to appeal in contested hearings once they were filed.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I'd like to try to quickly touch on five quick points. First of all, the question Justice Jefferson asked about if any statutes specifically say there should not be appellate review. One example from this case in particular is in the Human Resources Code, section 40.066, says that the ALJ's decision is the final decision. And I would emphasize the definite article the. It didn't say it's a final decision, which would suggest it may be an appealable final decision. It says it is the final decision. And a reasonable inference from that is that it means what it says. A second point that was referenced just a moment ago by a respondent and was also argued at great length by amici is the notion of incorporating the APA by reference. And there are several responses to that that I think are worth considering. First of all, when the Human Resources Code does that, for example, in section 42024 or section 42072B, it says proceedings for a disciplinary action are governed by the APA. It uses the word proceedings, which I would suggest focuses on that is the basic procedural mechanism whereby the hearings will be governed. It does not speak to jurisdiction. It does not say trial court jurisdiction shall be found as under the APA. It says proceedings are governed by the APA. In addition to that, this court has said several times that one should not incorporate a waiver of sovereign immunity by reference. As recently as just this year in Wichita Falls versus Taylor, and also long before that in Duhart versus State, this court has said a reference doesn't automatically incorporate a waiver of sovereign immunity. The third point I'd like to focus on is something amici have argued. They've said parts of the APA are substantive. And they focused in particular on 2001-038, which on its face does allow a lawsuit there. The APA generally is a procedural mechanism. And procedural constraints, by their nature, can be necessary for subject matter jurisdiction, particularly in the case of a waiver of sovereign immunity. For example, a notice of appeal is a procedural step, but if a party fails to file a notice of appeal, it can defeat jurisdiction for that appeal going up. That's a very different thing from saying a procedural mechanism can grant subject matter jurisdiction, particularly if it doesn't purport to do so. Now, 038 on its face purports to grant jurisdiction and has been interpreted to allow declaratory relief on the validity or application of a rule. But that's one specific section that is on its face granting jurisdiction. The APA as a whole is a procedural code, and particularly with waivers of sovereign immunity, before those waivers should be inferred, there should be, as this court has said, express and unambiguous language to that effect.
But there's no express waiver in 038. That's just what you got through saying. It says you can file a declaratory judgment. It doesn't. The last sentence doesn't say, and we, in addition, we waive sovereign immunity to make sure this provision means something.
Your Honor, that's right, but there we're not aware of an interpretation of that provision that makes any sense other than to understand that as allowing subject matter jurisdiction, conferring subject matter jurisdiction for that very limited purpose. In this context, it's possible to understand 171 as an exhaustion requirement. And in addition, there is the fact that there are all the other statutes, both at issue in this case and more broadly, that are rendered superfluous. And under the continental casualty reasoning, reference in one and omission in the other is very strong indication that the legislature intended not to allow judicial review where it omitted it.
But it's matter of structure also. I mean, all these enabling statutes had to be there before the 1976 Administrative Procedure Act, because that was the first General Administrative Procedure Act. And so it's not surprising to find a bunch of enabling statutes that a few of them grant judicial review. I mean,
yes,
we didn't go from no judicial review to, you know, to some when we passed the Administrative Procedure Act.
But there are a number since 76 that still have those provisions. So it's not...
That have
not
been enacted since then.
I believe that is correct, and we will discuss that in thorough detail.
I hope your fifth point is the vested property right.
Very briefly, that point we would submit is controlled by continental casualty. The parties did not plead it, argue it in any way, shape, or form in the district court. They did not so much as cite the Texas Constitution. Continental casualty said where there was no mention of, quote, an inherent right to review or, quote, due process, then it is waived on appeal. And I would note the amici implicitly concede that continental casualty forecloses this because the principal site they rely on for this is the dissent in the continental casualty. But even on the face of the chief's dissent in that case, in footnote one, that dissent makes clear that that dissent was predicated on the fact that the parties there had argued it in the district court. They just had not formally amended their complaint. And both the majority that explicitly adopted the Third Circuit Carrizales opinion and the dissent in footnote one both agree that if it's not raised until appeal, it's gone. And so, Your Honor, I would suggest that that opinion unanimously, both the majority and dissent, agrees that if they don't raise it until they get to the Court of Appeals, they can't go back and raise a brand new claim there.
Any other questions?
One more point on the, this was raised in the dissent in our case in the Court of Appeals about the good time credits and prisoner appeals, that being an example of would overwhelm the courts. Like that goes back to some, maybe the Austin Court of Appeals opinions way back when. Do you have any knowledge that that actually would be a problem? I mean, do we know that good time credits are contested cases, or is that speculation? And also, there's a specific exception in the 2001, it's 2001-226, that just on its face would seem to exempt this. It says the chapter does not apply to an internal procedure of the Texas Department of Criminal Justice or Texas Board of Criminal Justice that applies to an inmate or other person under custody control of the department or to an action taken under that rule or procedure. Now, that's an overall exception out of the Administrative Procedure Act. Would that cover this good time, Craig? I mean, that's the only example that seems to flow through some of these dissents and opinions that that's going to be the floodgates, and I just don't know that that's a reality.
I don't know specifically that that exception would cover that. It's certainly true the Third Court has been concerned for some two decades now about
this exception was passed in 1993, so it could be a legislative response to the good time credit argument.
We will endeavor in conferring with our many client agencies to give this court some sort of good faith estimate of the practical implications of this. But that being said, I do know as a general matter that unforeseen consequences can easily come from what would be a blanket grant of subject matter jurisdiction for every agency, and I would suggest the legislature is much better suited to make those determinations, that there's an intuitive sense in the legislature's making this judgment, enabling statute by enabling statute, because they can make a judgment that maybe with respect to good time credit, it shouldn't apply there, but with respect to another form of administrative procedure, it should apply. And that's inherently a legislative judgment, which is why it should be their call whether and when to waive sovereign immunity.
Thank you, counsel.
Well, could you have the answer off the top of your head to my question about the federal APA?
Your Honor, the federal APA, there is a case from the U.S. Supreme Court, Califano versus Sanders, which is at 430 U.S. 99, decided in 1977, that determined that Section 702 of the federal APA did not grant had to be found.
Is the language the same?
It is not the same, but it is similar. It's a much more complicated provision, and so there are portions of it that are similar, but it's not the same.
Thank you. That concludes the arguments in today's cases. The marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.